You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, guys. How's it going?
Hello, chaps. How are you?
Not too bad.
Wow. Wow.
Energetic old start to this week's podcast.
Like somebody's taken...
The battery's out.
What's the matter?
I'm fine.
Get the energy levels up. We're going to talk about cycling.
He needs a cappuccino. First thing to note, of course, is that the music has changed. It's reverted back by popular demand. We changed the music a few weeks ago. It had a big reaction. And we said that we were going to listen to what people said. The will of the people has decided that we should change back to Glass Pear. We will be using the other music from time to time and bits and pieces and specials and so on. In fact, you can hear it in the current... Matt Heyman's special talking about his win at Paris-Roubaix last year, but we have changed back to Glass Pear by popular demand, so hope you're happy, folks. You can stop tweeting now. about that.
Are we now going to find out that the new music was also wildly popular and there'll be we've split our listenership bang down the middle, 52-48?
This is going to smoke out all the fans of the new music. Yeah, well, we'll see. We might do it week about. You never know. We're open to anything. Anyway, we're going to talk about some bicycle racing in this week's episode, especially the Tour of Flanders, of course, that we just all witnessed at the weekend. Incredible performance by Philippe Gilbert to win that. A monstrous performance, said Sean Kelly, who sounded unusually excited in the Eurosport commentary box. But before we do that, Lionel, can you give us our news roundup, please?
I certainly can, and it's all about the racing, really, this week, isn't it? The Tour of Flanders, it's hard to know what the biggest story of the race was. Was it Tom Bonan's mechanical at the bottom of the Tyrenberg, which is a climb that has... No, it wasn't, was it? But that's a climb that he's attacked on many times in his career, but he came to grief at the foot of that on Sunday. Was it Sepp Van Marck's crash on the concrete roads? No, probably not. Was it Philippe Gilbert's long-distance attack? Or was it the crash on the Quadamont, where Peter Sagan... hit the barrier, or was it the jacket? We don't know. We'll have to discuss that later on in the episode. Would Philippe Gilbert have held on to win the race had it not been for that crash? We'll debate that as well. Gilbert added to an incredibly impressive list of one-day race wins in his career, winning the Tour of Flanders. Greg Van Avermaet took the sprint for second place ahead of Nicky Terpstra, and Cannondale's Dylan Van Baarle was in fourth place. The other big story that we must talk about is... Did Nicky Terpstra run over Peter Sagan's sunglasses on the Quadamont on purpose, or was it just an accident? Anyway, the Tour of Flanders is the bulk of the episode today. The second Walloon to win the race, Philippe Gilbert was, after Claude Criquillion 30 years ago. In the women's race, after her stunning breakthrough win at the Trofeo Alfredo Binda last month and a third place at Gent-Wevelgem a couple of weeks ago, or a week or so ago, America's Corinne Rivera won the Women's Tour of Flanders for Team Sunweb. She won the 16-rider sprint ahead of Gracie Elvin of Orica Scott, Chantal Black of Bowles Dolman, and Annemiek van Vleuten, also of Orica Scott. In Spain, there's a lot of racing going on. The Tour of the Basque Country is on now, and we'll finish at the weekend. But just before that got underway, there was the Grand Prix Miguel Indurain, won by Simon Yates. So a pretty good week for Orica across men's and women's cycling. He won a solo victory there ahead of Michael Woods of Cannondale and Sergio Henao of Team Sky. Finally, not quite cycling related news, but great news for us because we've been included on a shortlist of five in the sport category of the British Podcast Awards. Thanks very much to the judges for considering us for that award. We'll find out at the end of the month whether we've won. There's also a listener's prize. So everyone out there, if you like our podcast, please do vote for us at www.britishpodcastawards.com. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can't believe that made the news roundup, Lionel. Wow, but... Wow. That's okay. That's fine. So, Philippe Gilbert, you're shrugging. Philippe Gilbert. But as you say, Lionel, there were lots of talking points from the race, not least Terpstra's manoeuvre across Sagan's glasses. They, of course, had a falling out the previous week in Gent-Wevelgem, and when one of them allowed the gap to open to Greg Van Avermaet and Jens Kuchelaer, and had a bit of a slagging match afterwards in the press when Nicky Terpstra rode up the Audi Quaremont and saw that Sagan had crashed. His glasses were there in the middle of the road. He aimed for them, went straight across the bridge of the nose. No question, it was deliberate.
Really? No question.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about that. I'm just making that up. In my mind, it is deliberate based on one photograph that I've seen of the incident, because it wasn't on the TV footage that I could see. But anyway, the point is that here that Terpstra was way off the back at that point. And in fact, Dylan Van Baarle was off the back as well. You know, that group that was forming at that particular point in the race of Van Avermaet, Sagan and Nason, would they, the burning question is, would they have caught Philippe Gilbert? And I think they probably would they not?
Yeah, I think they probably would have caught Gilbert with Sagan's added firepower, Rich. But, I mean, generally I thought Sagan rode he had a bit of a stinker. Not only was he positioned poorly on the Mur van Gerardsbergen, when Sky and Quickstep Floors went to the front and put the pressure on, I mean, there was a crash earlier and that was probably why he was so far back, but he should have really been closer to the front and avoided the delays that ensued after that crash. Then he was obviously trying to gain an advantage by riding on the dirt at the side of the Quaremont. Bit of a stupid thing to do. I think we know now what caused the crash. It was a jacket. He snagged his handlebars on the jacket, but the barrier feet were also quite a long way towards the road. However, you know, this is not a football match where it's clearly defined where the pitch starts and where the pitch ends. There's no linesman running up the side of the Eau de Quaremont telling him where he can and can't ride. He should have been, well, he's experienced enough now to know what risks you're taking by riding in those positions. Interestingly, I noticed that Oliver Narsen, who was behind Greg Van Avermaet, who was behind Sagan, actually did hit the barrier without any further or anything else affecting his trajectory. So he, in Sagan's case, he hit the jacket, or he snagged on the jacket, and that moved his front wheel towards the barrier. I think he would have missed the barrier had it not been for the jacket. And people complaining about the spectators and so forth, but as I say, Sagan really shouldn't have been there in the first place.
I think you're right, Daniel. It's the risk-reward factor. Sagan trying to gain a tiny advantage by riding on the smooth bit, and the race organisers, particularly the Tour of Flanders, after the week, I'm not saying that they put the barriers where they put them purely as a response to the riders all going on pavements and seeking the smoothest path through cobbled sections, because the barrier placement would have been decided before those races. But it's clear that the biggest of all the events, you know, has got way more barriers on the course, and one of those reasons is to keep the spectators back so they can't crowd the riders, obviously, and one of those reasons is to make sure that the riders ride on the cobbles. And so it's, you know, Sagan really has only himself to blame in trying to get as far over as he possibly could. It's all very well saying, well, that barrier foot that he did hit was sticking out more than the others. Well, yes, it was, but they're trying to put barriers on an uneven piece of grass up the side of a cobbled road. And so really the riders have to take the responsibility. He's seeking the best possible line in terms of speed and the amount of energy it's costing him to get up the Quaremont. And it's basically cost him and Van Avermaet and Oliver Narsen the race. The other thing about, we started this by asking, would Gilbert have stayed away had it not been for that crash? And I agree with you, Daniel. I think that they would have caught him simply because Van Avermaet, Sagan, Narsen, others perhaps involved in the chase, they would have had a great incentive. The gap on the line was only 29 seconds as it was, and that was with Van Avermaet doing a huge amount of the work on the flat section after the last climb. It's a draggy, I think almost 8 kilometres of just draggy dead roads to the finish in Aldenada. And, they nearly did it. You know, Gilbert really had to dig very, very deep to preserve his advantage. But we can't take anything away from Gilbert's victory. It was one of the great performances, taking off so far from the finish. Sean Kelly, you know, is not often awestruck, and we noticed that in his commentary He said he'd not witnessed a performance like that either when racing the Tour of Flanders or watching it. So that has to count for something. And it's the ultimate lesson, isn't it? If you put yourself up the road and you get yourself away from all of the possible obstructions and drama and dangers behind, then you give yourself the best possible chance of winning the race. And that is exactly what Gilbert did.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Lionel. Fortune favours the brave, doesn't it? I mean, there are a few things to pick up on. That chase that involving Van Avermaet and Van Baarle in the end, Van Baarle, as I believe his name is pronounced, they had Nicky Terpstra sitting on the back. And psychologically, that can be tricky. I don't think Terpstra would have been on the back of a chasing Van Avermaet, Sagan and Nason. I think he was too far back. Could be wrong. It might have come back together a little bit after Quaremont. But, that was perhaps a factor, knowing that Terpstra was sitting there and, you know, had they caught or got close to Gilbert, you know, with fresher legs, he might have been able to attack. Who knows? He was a sort of anchor there. You say that Sagan rode a terrible race. He was chasing the race, and that's always a more difficult thing to do. But had he not crashed, there's a lot of ifs, buts and maybes here, but had he not crashed and had those three organised themselves and caught Gilbert, he would have stood a very, very good chance indeed of winning. And then we'd have said he rode a great race. The big talking point, I suppose, as well as all the other talking points, was the fact that the winning move went so early on the Moor, 95 kilometres to go. Van Avermaet infamously now said before the race that wouldn't be decisive. That certainly seemed to dictate his tactics going in. He was pretty far back going up there, so was Sagan. And Quickstep and Sky really took it on. And I watched it again this morning, actually, just how aggressive those two teams were. And noticed Gilbert speaking quite a lot to Luke Rowe, and Tom Bonin speaking to Luke Rowe as well. So I don't know what they were discussing. But those two teams really did, really rode very aggressively into the Moor over it and forced that split. And in a race like the Tour of Flanders, when you watch the chase behind, you're not talking about, you know, 7-8 man teams sitting on the front trying to bring that strong group back. You're talking about, you know, one or two BMC riders, one or two Orica riders, some Astana riders as well. You know, those domestiques, the likes of Daniel Oss, were chasing a group that was being driven by Tom Bonin and the rest. So it was a very interesting way to ride the race. And for once, I think we can say hats off to Quickstep as well for, really using the numbers that they had to great effect.
Well, Rich, you say if Sagan hadn't crashed, I mean, you know, if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a wheelbarrow,
I hope she's not listening, as they say in Italy.
I think Sagan, the vulnerability of Sagan's Bora Hans Grohe team was highlighted. He really needed power in numbers. I think specifically Quickstep Floors and Sky spoke on the morning of the race about making it hard on the Moor, and that was with a view both to exploiting the weakness of the Bora team and possibly to punishing Van Avermaet for what he'd said in the press about the Moor not being decisive, or certainly seizing upon what they saw as an opportunity, because he obviously, he didn't seem as though he was going to be particularly watching out for anything decisive to happen there. And then, of course, Quickstep really lured Sky, I suppose, into the trap, in the sense that, you know, they both wanted to make it hard there, but one team was much, much stronger than the other, and Quickstep had the great luxury of being able to send someone off down the road, as it was Philippe Gilbert. I mean, Gilbert himself said that he attacked on the Quaremont the first time around, or he accelerated and didn't really intend to persist, but then looked back, there was a big gap, and then we saw on the tarmac road that is often actually proven not decisive but a key point in the race, the tarmac road at the end of the Quaremont. There's a big dip in the road, and it seems like a fairly innocuous part of the course, but it's often been somewhere where indecision has caught as grip teams or riders and decisive moves have gone. And that was really, well, it was the first time they hit that road, or the first time that Gilbert hit that road, where he looked back and decided that there was enough of a gap to make it worth his while to at least give it a go. And sure enough, it worked.
Just on the way that the race panned out right from the start, I mean, a lot is made of how hard it is to get into the early break, and there's a lot of excitement about watching attack after attack after attack. And in the past, in the recent past, we've seen a Tour of Flanders where, you know, it's taken 40 kilometres for the opening move to get away. It was really interesting this year as they came out of Antwerp that, what, you know, the first move went very, very early once the flag had dropped. Four riders pretty much just rode off the front, and then shortly after that, four riders rode across the gap, and that set the set the tone for the race. And I wondered whether, you know, it was the fact that the Muir was back and so far from the finish, it was almost like a sort of finishing line for the first phase of the race in a way. The first climb was the first descent of the Al de Quadamont, and the sprint into the bottom of that was chaotic, hectic. Riders were trying to dart up the inside on the left-hand side of the road. One rider who got caught out trying to gain places into the corner was Alexander Kristoff, and he found himself right at the back. Then we didn't see a great deal of what was going on at the back on the Muir, but one thing's for certain is that it spread the peloton out over a very long way, because it's a long climb once you come over the bridge that goes over the railway, I think it is, and then up through the town and then up to the Kapelmuir at the top. It's quite a lot of climbing. It stretched the bunch out a lot, really put the pressure on. And then there was this whole sort of concertinaing effect, which is probably what caused all of the crashes that happened on the next number of climbs. It seemed every climb after that, whether cobbled or smooth, riders at the back or towards the back were getting caught, touches of wheels, people having to put their foot down. And all that takes a tremendous toll. And just trying to stay in the front positions was something that Sky and Quickstep Floors obviously did very well. And when you consider that not everything went perfectly for them, Quickstep Floors, Yves Lampaert had a puncture at a bad time, Tom Bonham was ruled out of the race on the Tyrenberg, and yet, you know, they still had a very powerful card to play in Gilbert. And really, now we look back at his results from the last couple of weeks, second at Oise Dour Vlaanderen, second at the Grand Prix E3 Harelbeke, a stage win and an overall at the 3 days of Dapana, a very impressive stage win there. It all seems so obvious that once he took that flyer, he was going to, you know, win the Tour of Flanders, and that's how it turned out.
Hi, I'm Chris Hoy, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast, supported by Science in Sport.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. A reminder that you can get 20% off Science and Sport products if you go to scienceandsport.com and enter the discount code CPOD20, that's CPOD20, that's a new code, that will get you 20% off all products that are not part of any existing offer. So get your Science and Sport gels, drinks, energy bars, all the rest of it there. And thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for sponsoring Cycling Podcast. And we've got some other offers and things and competitions to tell you about at the start of part three, so keep listening for that. We were going to carry on talking about the Tour of Flanders. I mean, you know, we probably haven't paid enough respect to Philippe Gilbert for his extraordinary performance. I mean, he is a rider who, When he hits form, he really, really hits form, doesn't he? He can blow a bit hot or cold. I don't think we've seen him in this kind of form since 2011. I think it was his real purple patch before he joined BMC. And, you know, he joined BMC on a 3-year contract. And apart from the odd great success, such as a world title, he stagnated a little bit. And I wonder if, I think we're seeing this year, he and Greg Van Avermaet are both riding exceptionally well. They've, of course, been teammates the last few years. Didn't really get on, I don't think. Did they, Daniel? You might have some insight into that. But certainly kind of similar riders and in some ways. And it seems that both have been sort of liberated by not being teammates anymore. And as I say, both riding much, much better.
Yeah, I mean, Gilbert's had a strange career that's gone in several very distinct phases. When he was under 23, he was very successful, but He was a bit of a lone wolf at the ABX Go Pass team, it was called, and he was riding against a hugely strong Domo Latexco team. They were called. They had Geert Stiegmans, Nick Nooyens, Johan van Summeren, Jurgen van den Broek, and Gilbert really had to do it all on his own. And then he signed as a pro for La Française des Jeux, which seemed a strange move at the time. A lot of the Belgian teams were fishing around, were interested in him. I think Quickstep wanted to sign him back then, but Marc Madiot, the FDJ manager, seemed keener and invited Gilbert, or went to Gilbert's house, I seem to recall. There he really arrived in a team that was very down on its luck and very down on the situation in professional cycling. Talked a lot about cyclisme à deux vitesses, two-speed cycling. They felt that everyone else basically was doping and they weren't. And, I spoke to Gilbert a few years ago after he'd left La Française des Jeux, and he talked about how Madiot's very outspoken nature and his constant, his very frequent statements about doping and suggestions that other teams were doping, FDJ weren't, how that really affected Gilbert. I remember he won a stage in the Dauphiné in 2006, and Madiot made some comments in the press that evening, and then the next day Alejandro Valverde and Oscar Pereiro confronted Gilbert in the peloton, and Gilbert he protested that he had nothing to do with what Madiot had said and that they should leave him alone. But I mean, the impression I got, and Gilbert certainly suggested that over the years, he started to get a bit fed up with Madiot in particular, focusing on the issue of doping. And then he moved to Silence Lotto, I think it was, when he first joined them, and really became one of the Galacticos, didn't he? One of the really big hitters, certainly in one-day races, started to win classics and monuments on a regular basis, and was very much became the darling of the Belgian press, the Belgian fans. Really overtook Tom Boonen, because his Gilbert's pomp really coincided with a bit of a difficult period in Boonen's career. And as you say, Rich, had that annus mirabilis in 2011, and then seemed to lose momentum really after he became the world champion in 2012 and moved to BMC. This conflict with Van Avermaet, Gilbert didn't feel that he was going to get much freedom in the Cobble Classics and switched his focus back to the Ardennes, which now looks as though it was perhaps a mistake. He also became slightly prickly with journalists when he was at BMC. I remember he had a new manager, and there was talk of him asking for money for interviews, and the Belgian press almost shunned him for a while. And then he's gone to Quickstep. Midway through last year, he actually had an offer to join Fortuneo Vital Concept, the French team, a three-year offer. He didn't feel that they were riding on the level that he wanted to be performing on. So he called up Patrick Lefebvre, the Quickstep Floors manager, and offered his services for a year, a fairly substantial salary cut, but with fairly big bonuses, I'm led to believe. And that's where he's ended up, at Quickstep. And, you know, Quickstep's future is still uncertain for next year. The team doesn't have a sponsorship deal for next year. I think Patrick Lefebvre is actually meeting some prospective sponsors this week. But Gilbert wants to stay there. I think if Lefebvre manages to pull out a deal, then that's what he will do.
I think putting Gilbert on a one-year contract with a relatively low salary and big win bonus is probably a very smart move.
Well, if the results of this spring are anything to go by, certainly. And it's interesting, we're reading in the press today that Gilbert will not ride Paris-Roubaix and will take a little bit of a break and then come back for Amstel Gold, possibly Flesh Wallonne, Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And when you look at Gilbert's career and all the one-day races he's won, he had that incredible spring, that was in 2011, wasn't it, when he won not only Amstel, Flesh and Liège in the space of a week, but he preceded that with the Brabantse Peel as well, sort of four of the hilly classics over on the other side of Belgium, and one in Holland as well. But let's not forget that he did win Het Volk twice, 2006, 2008, before it changed its name to Het Nieuwsblad. The 2008 victory, I remember, because I was there, and it was a really imposing performance. Perhaps not quite on the same level as Sunday's performance, but in a similar vein, he went 50-ish kilometres from the finish, he attacked on the Eikenberg and hammered away into a headwind. And Sunday's performance was, you know, it exceeded that in terms of how impressive it was. And there's certainly something about Gilbert when he gets away alone. You watch the way that he uses the road. You know, he knows every corner. You know, he's draping his hands over the handlebars, and the team car did him a few turns as well, didn't it? Wilfried Peters, wily old fox, knows exactly how to drive alongside. Oh, tactical genius. I mean, you know, who wouldn't suggest attacking 50-ish kilometres from the finish of the Tour of Flanders? I mean, it's just so obvious, isn't it?
We've always been a big admirer of his work. Well, actually, it did make me smile. The Gilbert, he talks about this moment of hesitation when he'd gone off the front and he got a decent gap. He didn't really know whether he should persist or not, but he said that the deciding factor at that point was the fact that he couldn't hear anything from the radio. There was no connection with the team car. And he thought that while they re-established connection or tried to re-establish connection, he would just carry on anyway. One wonders whether Wilfried Peters would have made the right decision. Of course he would. Of course he would.
Well, he seemed to be running out of gas a little bit on the run, and it's a tough sort of dead running, isn't it? I mean, the last 2 years we've been treated to quite an exciting finale with Sagan last year away in that stretch, and Gilbert this year appearing to perhaps start to run a bit low on energy, not surprisingly. But is it too long? I mean, it's quite a long way from the Paterberg, 15 kilometres or so of pretty featureless road. As I say, we have been served up some relatively exciting finales, but I don't know, it just seems odd to finish the race with such a long stretch of featureless road.
Well, it's probably, it used to be 12 kilometres from the top of the Bosberg. I think the thing with this finish now is not the fact that it's a 15 kilometres, but that it's that last 8 kilometres, which if it's not on the same road, it's certainly, you know, it's on very, very similar roads. And perhaps you can see from the camera shots, but you can see the 5 kilometre, 4 kilometre, 3 kilometre banners, you know, looming ahead. But it's not dissimilar to the old finish into Ninove, where again, a sort of, it's that, it just teases the riders out. The climb is sort of far enough to be a springboard, but not so close that an attack there means that it's a done deal. And I think they've just about got that balance right, because it was hanging in the balance whether it would come back together again. And I think had the crash not happened on the Al de Quadamont, the power in that group behind would have seen it be extremely close on the finish, and perhaps a sort of heartbreaking catch within sight of the line. So it's there to test the riders, isn't it? It's far enough to frighten them, but it is doable if a rider's on a great day.
Well, it hasn't put off riders striking out on their own, and obviously the last two editions have been won by solo breakaways. I'm amazed we've got this far into the podcast without mentioning the other performance.
Telepathic.
Of the day.
I was about to say exactly the same thing, in almost exactly the same, with almost exactly the same words.
Great minds. Who is it? Who is it, Daniel?
Is it il pavone di Sandrigo? The peacock of Sandrigo, the mighty Filippo Pozzato.
Joking apart, though, I mean, the whole point of Filippo Pozzato these days is that he's not supposed to be very good. And yet, occasionally, he'll produce a performance that shows his class, really, doesn't it? I mean, he did ride extremely well.
He did, but he was frustrated at the end. He thought he could have done even better, and the team were also frustrated, not because they thought he could have won the race or finished even higher up, but because he rarely rides in that fashion in races which he could win. You know, the sort of smaller Italian Cup races, which really are that team and Willis Selle Italia's bread and butter, or focaccia and olive oil. We tend to get a steady stream of inside information about Filippo Pozzato from our very good friend Ciro Scognamiglio. And there was even the scurrilous rumour earlier this year that the Trofeo Laiguelia, which was a race that Pozzato has won several times in the past, he pulled out this year because he was worried about catching a flight to the Canary Islands or something to that effect.
he's not a man maybe to perform in, you know, on a Tuesday evening in Stoke or whatever the Italian equivalent of Stoke is, but he'll pull it out for the on the big stage, the big occasion.
Yeah, eighth place, a great result. And again, you know, he's always there in the mix, wasn't he? Lurking. I thought if it all come back down together, we might have seen a fairy tale to make Ciro spring.
If it all came down to a tanning contest in Udinada, he was in with a shout. That was what you were thinking, wasn't it?
Yeah, best tattoos as well, maybe. Just a quick word on Cannondale, because the other one of the pre-race favourites, or sort of certainly second level favourite, Sepp van Marcke, had a real terrible spring, really. Been unlucky with crashes and illness, coming in not 100%, I suspect, van Marcke for Cannondale. And then on that fast, slightly downhill, slightly turning, you know, stretch, the concrete roads, a lot of speculation about whether or not he caught his front wheel in the join between the concrete slabs. Or whether it just slipped away from him. Either way, he went down very, very heavily. Luke Rowe, who was on his wheel, went down as well, and that affected Sky's race as well. But Cannondale, I mean, I'm starting to wonder who it is in the Cannondale camp, whether it's Jonathan Vaughters or Andreas Klier, who's been kicking black cats all winter, because their luck really doesn't seem to be in. Although, having said that, Dylan Van Baarle did salvage something from the race, although narrowly missed out on a podium position, largely because Nicky Terpstra had a completely free ride to the line.
Hi, I'm Darius. I head up Rafa Travel, which is our cycling holidays business, and I've been here 10 months. Rafa Travel organises cycling holidays all over the world of varying difficulties, varying lengths. The place that really caught me by surprise was LA. One of our staff, who is based out there, took us for a ride, and we went from the centre of Santa Monica up into the hills in about 20 minutes, and you know, you could have been hundreds of miles from the city. We really focus on making experiences that guests just couldn't organise by themselves, and whether that's going to factories or going to local producers, those are the things that you could only do if you came with us.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our main sponsor. You heard there from Darius of Rafa Travel. And in fact, this week's competition prize in their Monuments competition is to win a Rafa Travel holiday and Rafa clothing set. As with their other Monuments competitions, the challenge is to guess the winning time of Paris-Roubaix. The winning time last year, Matt Heyman's winning time, I looked this up.
I've got this, Rich. Last year it was 5 hours, 51 minutes, 53 seconds, winning time for Matt Heyman.
From memory, it was a fast one last year, wasn't it?
It could be again this year if it's, the prevailing wind blowing them up from Compiègne, and weather forecast looks good, so dry, dusty, could be. It's very similar again.
Yeah, there was actually a recce or some kind of press junket earlier this week. Lionel and friend of the podcast, Christian Prudhomme, who of course is also the director of Paris-Roubaix as well as the Tour de France, he said he'd never seen the cobbles looking so clean and so dry. So yeah, we can expect a very quick race.
Back to the competition. If you want to log into rafa.cc/win, that's rafa.cc/win, you can enter your estimate for a winning time. And I say the prize, Rafa Travel Holiday, Rafa Clothing Set. But just by entering the competition, you can get 20% off all your Rafa products. So well worth entering that competition.
These are cracking prizes, Rich. These are cracking prizes. I mean, it's a shame we're not eligible.
It is a shame we're not eligible. A couple of other Rafa related announcements. On the 20th of April in London at the, I think it's the Rafa Clubhouse in Spitalfields. There are two in London, of course, one in Soho, one in Spitalfields. I think it's the Spitalfields one. Lionel and I will be joining Paul Voss, the former rider, now a budding young sports director. Paul Voss, a German ex-rider, King of the Mountains briefly at the Tour de France last year, and how could we forget Pedlar de Charme at the Tour de France last year. Paul Voss will be in conversation with us, and we'll be talking about being a sports director. He is learning the trade, and we'll talk about lots of things with Paul. That event is open to members of the Rafa Cycling Club and also friends of the podcast. So if you are a friend of the podcast, you will be eligible to come along to that. We'll send you an email at some point very soon. A week after that, 27th of April, I am taking part in an event. I think Orla Shinawi is joining me with members of the Canyon SRAM team in Manchester at the Rafa Cafe in Manchester. Hannah Barnes will be there, and perhaps another Canyon SRAM rider as well. A couple of nights before that, on the 25th of April in Leeds, I'll be joining Orla Shinawi as well in conversation with Lizzie Dignan. Her new book is coming out very soon, and we'll be doing an event at Watterson's in Leeds on the 25th of April. If you go to the Watterson's website, you'll find out how to get tickets for that. And as I say, two nights later in Manchester, Orla and I will be joining Hannah Barnes of Canyon SRAM. So lots coming up there. And as I say, friends of the podcast will get an email about the event with Paul Voss. While we're talking about friends of the podcast, we should just say that you can become a friend of the podcast at thiscyclingpodcast.com. Our new episode is Matt Heyman telling us how he won Paris-Roubaix last year. And that's a fascinating insight from Matt Heyman. There's a little trailer from that if you want to hear a bit. We're going to hear a little bit from Matt Heyman this episode from that special about how it'll feel to line up this year with the number one on his back. And there's another little bonus for friends of the podcast this week, isn't there, Lionel?
Oh, yeah, there is. Yeah, we've got a short piece on Tom Bonin going out for Friends of the Podcast. It will appear in the Friends of the Podcast 2017 feed, I think, on Friday. Just before
Bonin bonus,
yeah, just before his final Paris-Roubaix, his career will, all being well, will come to an end in the Roubaix Velodrome on Sunday afternoon. Maybe it will come to an end on the highest possible note with a victory. Who knows?
And that is in addition to the 11 friends specials that you will get throughout the year. The next one will be a Giro special that the three of us got together. We got together in London last week to record, and that was very enjoyable. So that will be coming out just before the Giro. You mentioned just before the break there, Daniel, about Sepp van Marck. Taylor Finney, of course, as well, was another crash victim for Cannondale, another new rider. And they, you know, they've had so much bad luck. The big marquee signings last year, Rigoberto Urán, fell ill at the Giro. Pierre Roland kept crashing at the Tour de France. Now their marquee signings this year, really Sepp van Marck and Taylor Finney, have both had very troubled starts to the season. Taylor Finney's had a knee injury, and he seemed to knock himself out on Sunday there. I think he still hopes to ride Paris-Roubaix. We're not sure about Sepp van Marck. I imagine he will be desperate to ride Paris-Roubaix. But coming up for 2 years, I think, since their last World Tour win. So lean times.
Do you know what
deep.
It was? Do you know what it
their
was,
last
Rich?
World Tour win.
Yeah. Napalm?
Was it? It was... I can't remember.
Davide Formolo.
Was it?
At the Giro.
Yeah.
At the Giro. The stage one at the Giro, of course. Yeah. Well, they have had rotten luck, but salvaged something a little bit on Sunday, at least with Dylan van Baarle, who did, that was a bit of a coming of age performance for him.
I think he's got a great chance in Paris-Roubaix, I would suggest.
24 years old, a young rider still, isn't he? What do we think of Paris-Roubaix then? Is it script? I mean, Tom Bonin, terrible luck with his bikes at the weekend. Seemed to have a problem with the chain when he went to change. The chain came off, and then the same thing happened with the spare bike, and it was a real palaver and a sorry end to his Tour of Flanders career. But is it scripted for him to come good? He's obviously going well.
Well, he obviously is, and he said that at the end of the Tour of Flanders on Sunday that he was disappointed because he felt that he was pretty much the best of the rest after Gilbert, or one of the best of the rest. The very interesting subplot as far as Quickstep are concerned, or there are two interesting subplots. One is how Boone's teammates are going to try to honour his retirement. So are they going to sacrifice all of their chances? The other, of course, is that, as I mentioned earlier, Quickstep, or the team, currently has no sponsor for next year. So in theory, every rider is on the market. And you know, you think of someone like Nicky Terpstra, who's had a great spring, great classic season so far, but really not achieved any personal success, or not achieved any victories for himself. He launched Tom Boonen.
Tom Bonan. Bonan.
To victory in Paris-Roubaix in 2012, and then benefited from Boonen's help in 2014 to win himself. But so they're at sort of one favour each in Paris-Roubaix. But is he going to sacrifice all of his chances? Is Zdeněk Stybar going to do the same? And they also have Yves Lampaert, who's ridden very well in Paris-Roubaix in the past. It's a tricky
Matteo
one.
Trentin as well. Trentin is always, he's look, you know, you imagine that Paris-Roubaix is a race that should really suit him.
Yeah, it should do, and they have other firepower in the team as well. You know what my big concern about Quickstep is? They're obsessed. Did you know that they're obsessed with Pokemon? Did you know that?
No, didn't know this.
Yves Lampaert collects Pokemon. Marcel Kittel, I know Marcel Kittel is not going to be a factor at Paris-Roubaix, also collects. What do you do? Do you collect Pokemon napalm? Anyway,
where people go round with their phones. I mean, it's just going to take them off course.
Yeah.
Take them off course.
Well,
they've missed out the Arenberg because there's a Pokemon in the nearest village that they want to collect.
Yeah. What if the cobble sections at Roubaix are littered with Pokemon?
Don't tell me. Tom Bonan is into Pokemon.
It wouldn't shock me. He's very much down with the kids, isn't he, Tom Bonan? In all seriousness, though, it'll be a very poignant moment when Bonan ends his career on Sunday. A great, you know, regardless of the problems he had earlier in his career with, you know, a couple of positive tests, weren't there, for cocaine. Obviously, a very regrettable incident, but just in terms of purely in terms of his dealings with the press, I would say what a fantastic ambassador he's been for cycling. Someone who it's always an absolute joy to speak to and deal with, and a real professional who I'm sure is going to have an awful lot of success in whatever he embarks upon over the next few months. He says he's going to take 2 or 3 months to decide what his future is going to look like, but he's someone who.
Yeah, you mentioned Gilbert and how, you know, when he reached the very height of his fame, it did seem to change him a little bit. And although, as you say, Bonan had his problems, he moved to Monaco and, you know, lifestyle perhaps changed and friends changed a little bit. And, you know, he had some relationship problems, didn't he? And he had a couple of out-of-competition positive tests for cocaine. I think both of them just following this classics period when there's this enormous, not to excuse it at all, but there's this enormous pressure on him going to Flanders and Roubaix. Throughout all that, I think he remained a very affable, approachable, charming guy. It didn't seem to alter his personality at all. And we hear, in fact, in our Bonan bonus episode, Hugo Kurowitz, the Het Nieuwsblad journalist, talking a little bit about how throughout his career, Bonan has remained true to himself throughout all that. He returned to Belgium a few years ago, and that coincided with a return to form as well. You know, he had this incredible year in 2005, world champion, and, you know, started to dominate the cobbled classics. There was a period of time around 2006-7-8 when a lot of big names in cycling were falling by the wayside with positive tests and doping scandals. And there was a period when Bonan was the one sort of major star still standing, it seemed at times. It seemed like he was carrying the sport on his shoulders almost. But he survived all that. And, around about 2010-11, he started to pick up more of these cobbled classics. And, I don't think anybody saw him being such a strong contender in last year's Paris-Roubaix, because it did seem that he was in terminal decline, his career. But he produced an incredible performance last year, finished second to Matt Heyman, and the form he's in, it wouldn't be a huge surprise to see him certainly up there on Sunday fighting for the win.
And if he were to win it, it would be his fifth win at Paris-Roubaix, which would break, would mean that he steps above Roger de Vlaeminck, who also has 4 wins. De Vlaeminck is nicknamed still Monsieur Paris-Roubaix. Tom Bonan would... You know, I mean, he's very humble, isn't he? A couple of years ago on the podcast when I asked him, you know, how he would feel if he drew level with... if he overtook Roger de Vlaeminck, he said that, you know, de Vlaeminck would still be number one in his eyes. And when you look back at those 4 victories he's had, 2005 was the first one, you know, he out-sprinted George Hincapie and Juan Antonio Fletcher, and that really puts into context how long Bonan has been around and how long he's been at the top. Arguably, well, not arguably, there's no doubt that the most impressive of those four wins was the most recent of them, 2012, where he attacked, I think, certainly over 50 kilometres from the finish.
50 kilometres, yeah.
Yeah, unreal. I mean, Gilbert style. I mean, you know, that was a day when he was untouchable, and you know, over a minute and a half ahead of the next group. Last year, it was a surprise, wasn't it? I think as they were all approaching the velodrome, Bonan was the man that I thought was going to win. Heymans was a surprise. Everybody, I think, thought Bonan was going to win that, but for whatever reason, he just came up short. Can he do it? What do you reckon? Can he do it? I hate speculation, but it would be fantastic to see, wouldn't it?
Well, if you were Wilfred Peters, you weren't preoccupied with looking for Pokemon on Sunday, what would you do?
Well, I'd be just about sitting down for my second lunch.
Can I just say that in Flanders on Sunday and in Paris-Roubaix last year, what has really impressed me about the way that Bonan's run is that he's taken the race by the scruff of the neck early on. And he did that last year in Paris-Roubaix, again with some Quick-Step allies, and distanced Fabian Cancellara and Peter Sagan. And a very similar thing happened. Sagan didn't crash, but Cancellara crashed. Sagan was sort of held up by it. And again, that was what's ifs, buts and maybes. Had Cancellara not crashed, Sagan and Cancellara may have been a very potent chasing force. And Bonan really made his own luck last year in Paris-Roubaix by being at the front, taking it on, as he did on Sunday at the Tour of Flanders. And in a way, it's surprising to see a rider of his experience riding with such a sense of adventure, if you like, and a sense of risk, and not waiting for the race to unfold and for the strongest to emerge, but really taking it on. So I think that strategy on Sunday was what won Quick-Step the race. So I can see them trying a similar thing at Paris-Roubaix.
Also, Richard, on each of Boonen's previous four Paris-Roubaix victories, the weather has been pretty good. The cobbles have been pretty dry. I think that will favour him. I remember last year about Sagan and his technique over the cobbles. The fact that he's still very upright. He's got a good record in Paris-Roubaix, not a great record yet. And I actually think that a wetter, more treacherous course might suit Sagan better with the way he rides, his position on the bike. I think being very upright, it perhaps helps him to make adjustments when the cobbles are very sketchy. But on Sunday, I think you'll see riders like, or the bigger rulers, the guys who are more sort of stretched out, like Boonen on their bike, and possibly be an advantage. I would throw guys like Alexander Kristoff into the mix as well, and put him in that category. He's on good form, hasn't been lucky so far, but then you've also got guys like Degenkolb, and now we really are lurching dangerously into the realm of speculation. We're going to mention every rider in the field in a minute.
Luke Durbridge.
Should we just read out the start list for the last couple Let's of minutes of the podcast? Joking aside, I think the thing is with Paris-Roubaix is I think back to 2007 Stuart O'Grady's win, when really the race was decided by the early break, and Paris-Roubaix is not necessarily a race that fits into a set pattern. You know, really, it is a cliche, but anything could happen. If it's aggressive early, if there's a tailwind, that will be a factor. If a break gets up the road with some serious riders in it, that will be a factor. So in terms of, to answer your question, what would I do if I was Wilfred Peters? I'd wait and see how it pans out and hope that as many of my men as possible could stay as close to Bonan, Stibar, Lampert, Trentin, Terpstra. I mean, you know, they really have got half a dozen potential winners in that team, and the key is to be able to make the decisions on the road about who is the strongest and not allow sentimentality and not allow, you know, doubt over future contracts cloud the team tactics. That may well be the biggest challenge for them, but they are undoubtedly the overwhelming favourites, aren't they, because they've got so many potential winners. Everybody else has got sort of ones and twos.
Well, I mentioned last year's winner, Matt Heyman. Not sure about Matt Heyman's form. He hasn't really shown anything so far this year to suggest that a repeat could be on the cards. Although when I spoke to him for our friend's special, he said he was very determined to put on a good display and honour the number one that will be on his back. Also in that friend's special, I asked him how he thought it would feel to start the race as defending champion with the one on his back, and here's what he said.
Yeah, I'm hoping that that I still have that same the feeling that I had at the tour, where I was able to relax a little bit, and I hope that I'll be able to go into the tour, into Roubaix, having known that I don't, I've done that now. I really like to do another performance. To
it might not be so easy to get into that.
No, definitely break. Definitely not. But I'd like to consolidate that performance and show that it wasn't a one-off. And I mean, I've had some top tens before, but I'd really like to have a great day. And just I can't start Roubaix without any stress and without being nervous. But I'm hoping that it'll just be, with some pride and some self-assurance that I get to ride the race, and that I make sure that I enjoy it, because that's how what we're out there to enjoy racing, and sometimes you get caught up in the stress side of it and just want to get out there, ride the cobbles, enjoy it, and with number one, yeah, it's going to be a strange feeling.
So that was Matt Heyman looking ahead to his defence of his Paris-Roubaix crown, a very popular winner last year, and that says a lot for Matt Heyman, given that he beat a very popular rider in Tom Bonin. And Bonin, as he said, was very, very gracious after that. And Heyman said he wouldn't mind seeing Bonin win his final race on Sunday, although he would probably rather Luke Durbridge won. And Luke Durbridge is, as I mentioned, one of the favourites, rode well at 3 days of Japan and is a strong rider. And I think Paris-Roubaix is the race that suits him best. Anybody else to throw into the mix? I mean, Ian Stannard, third last year for Team Sky, hasn't shown much this spring to suggest he's in form. Luke Rowe, again, also has had some terrific performances at Paris-Roubaix a couple of years ago. I think he was fifth, wasn't he, at Paris-Roubaix? But he, I don't know, I'm not convinced by his form. If we're going to pick a winner, as I think we are, aren't we? I think Sagan's got to win Paris-Roubaix at some point, and I'm going to go for Peter Sagan for the winner on Sunday.
Well, does that mean you want me to name a winner as well, Rich?
Like, give us a winner and an outsider. I'm thinking about my outsider.
I backed Tony Martin a few weeks ago, very advantageous odds, but he didn't finish the Tour of Flanders, and I'm not sure what the reason for that was, but I liked the look of him a few weeks ago. I'll stick with that. Outsider, Florian Senechal of Cofidis. I've backed him every year for about 5 years now, and he's always let me down, but who knows, this could be the year.
And will do again. Pointless hipster's choice. That.
Okay, my outsider, I'm going to say, I don't know if he counts as an outsider still, but Oliver Nason, who obviously had that bad luck on Sunday, but is going very, very well, and rode decently last year at Paris-Roubaix. He's my outsider.
Not really an outsider, is he? He's about the fourth, well, fourth favourite.
All right, he's not in the first rank of favourites, though, is he?
He's about as much of an outsider as Boonen.
No, that's nonsense. Absolute nonsense.
He's been about fifth in every single classic this spring.
All right,
spring.
Okay, I'll think of someone else.
Fine. Well, I was going to... I mean, a similar thing. Durbridge, I don't think, fits into the outsider bracket. He's been too impressive this spring. Could be again. But I think the winner will be Alexander Kristoff.
All right, confident.
Outsider. Well, I've got money on him as well, so let's hope so. Let's hope so. Outsider, not really an outsider, but given Sky's woes with Rowe and Stannard, I think Gianni Moscon, maybe give him the get him into position and see what he can do.
Okay. I'm still got to come up with a an outsider that's acceptable to you guys. Then, yeah, is that the idea? Nicky Terpstra. Tash Benoit.
I mean, he's not even fifth favourite. Not even fifth favourite in his own team.
Seth Van
is he?
Mark. No, I don't know. I can't. I'm an outsider. Just going to pluck a name out there. Here.
This is why we don't do predictions, yeah. Isn't it?
Arnaud Demar.
It's becoming evident.
Can he count as an outsider?
Well, if we don't allow you to have him, we're going to be here all night, so we better allow
him. Arnaud Demar, though, don't you think? Also, he has a very good Pirate Bay in him.
Yes.
Surely you've got to pick somebody from Room Pop or 14A Vital
didn't,
Concept.
Didn't hear you do that. Come on. One
no,
rule,
well, I didn't.
One rule for you and another rule for everybody else, eh? Is that how it is? Anyway, this is not something we normally indulge in, this kind of idle speculation. I've mentioned
reason.
Enough names there that I can surely get some bragging rights on Sunday. We shall see. But anyway, we'll obviously be glued to Pirate Bay, and we'll be back next week. Anything else coming up, chaps, that we should look forward to?
Tour of the Basque Country. It's on our screens as we speak. There's 2.5 kilometres to go. We could do some as live commentary through the end of stage two here. No, I won't spoil it.
Okay, quickly on that. Philippe Gilbert obviously missing Pirate Bay to rest up for the Ardennes Classics. Dan Martin, obviously, and Julian Alaphilippe, who we saw suffer some dreadful luck at the end of stage one at the Tour of the Basque Country when he was away on his own and he had a rear wheel puncture. Those three riders are all Ardennes Classic specialists. I don't know whether Dan Martin is fancying himself more these days as a stage race rider, but is that gonna cause issues, or in those races is that just gonna be an advantage for all of them?
Well, it should be an advantage, Rich, but again, the big question mark over Quickstep's future comes into focus, doesn't it? Because, you know, there's a danger of it being every man for himself. And I think this is why Patrick Lefebvre is so keen to get this all sorted. He doesn't want to wait until the Tour de France. He wants it sorted in the next few weeks. He wants all of the riders to know where they stand vis-a-vis next year. Because otherwise, yeah, it could be a bit of a bun fight at Quickstep. I mean, it's certainly not affecting them at the moment, is it? They are, in fact, riding incredibly well. They've won an awful lot of races this year. And we saw this last year with I Am Cycling. You know, they had been they've not been very prolific at all throughout their history. And then as soon as the riders were effectively facing an ultimatum, they had to win races, they had to win World Tour points, they started popping off wins left, right and centre. And it doesn't really... It's not a particularly good reflection on, you know, how self-motivated riders are when they're not riding for their futures, but still.
But surely, I mean, it really, is there that much doubt that Patrick Lefebvre will get something signed? I mean, if you had to bet on anybody in the World Tour managing to line up a replacement sponsor, he'd be pretty high up the list. If he can't find someone, he'll just lock somebody in a room and not let them out until they've signed the contract and written the check out, is the impression I get, if we can get that past the lawyers.
on that note, let's wrap things up for this week. Daniel and I will be back next week. Whether Lionel is might depend on whether Patrick Lefebvre locks him up in a room between now and then. But thanks very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.
# pronunciation police. Here he is, Inspector Constable Rob Hatch. Oh, I didn't expect you to turn up in full uniform.
Oh, yeah, you have to put your shirt on. Yeah. Oh, I'm do. Oh, I'm. Check that one. Rigoberto Urán Urán. Urán Urán. Nobody says Urán Urán, but it's quite funny.
Do you get these pronunciations? Do you generally ask the writer or ask a native speaker?
A native speaker. Or if it's not possible to ask the writer or a native speaker, then you'll try your best to learn the phonetics of each language. So I don't speak German, for example, but you'll know that E-I is an I sound, I is an E sound.
But how far do you take it? Should French people call me Richard?
Richard.
should we call the Frenchman, I mean, Richard?
For example, I know you're not bothered about that. I'm not bothered about that. If I mean, I have Spanish friends, you know, I'm Rob or Roberto. But it's, I think if I'm talking on television and I'm saying somebody's name and their mum's watching, I think it's the polite thing. Diego Ulissi. Diego Ulissi. Ulissi. That's for Lionel, that. Diego Ulissi. John Degenkolb. It's one for Freeboss, isn't it? I don't do German, but...
Roger Kluger.
No, because I cocked up that one. Apparently he says Roger. Even though in German it is Roger. I've heard some really funny stories of people hearing stuff and getting offended when they hear things said wrong. And again, as well, what I say, I suppose, affects what a lot of other people say. That's their first contact with that name or that language or that rider. And I think that, yeah, if anybody's, you know, you've got the right to say it wrong. Anybody can say it. It doesn't matter, does it, if it's a conversation in the pub or down the street. But this is the official record on the telly of what's happening on the
home, on the home cycling.
On the home cycling, of course. And at the home cycling.
Hashtag home cycling. Hashtag pronunciation police.
Bahrain. Got some outtakes at the end of the year.